In the course of April, just before the lists were closed, Brock and Holtz became members of the Nazi Party. It would be wrong to say they were jumping on a bandwagon. Both had undoubtedly shared some opinions with the Nazis all along. Up to now, the party had not been strong enough to persuade them to join. The little extra was supplied by the recruiting power of victory. It became difficult to hold the group together. Von Hagen and Hirsch were kept very busy. Still, it managed to survive for another 5 or 6 weeks. Then at the end of May, there was a meeting at which it broke apart. It happened just after the mass murders in Köpenick. Brock and Holtz came to our meeting like murderers fresh from the deed. Not that they had taken part in the slaughter themselves, but it was obviously the topic of the day in their new circles. They had clearly convinced themselves that they were in some way accomplices. Into our civilized, middle-class atmosphere of cigarettes and coffee cups, the two of them brought a strange, blood-red cloud of sweaty death. They started to speak of the matter immediately. It was from their graphic descriptions that we found out what had actually happened. The press had only contained hints and intimations. "Fantastic what happened in Köpenick yesterday, eh?" began Brock, and that was the tone of his narrative. He went into detail, explained how the women and children had been sent into a neighbouring room before the men were shot point-blank with a revolver, bludgeoned with a truncheon, or stabbed with an S.A. dagger. Surprisingly, most of them had put up no resistance, and made sorry figures in their nightshirts. The bodies had been tipped into the river, and many were still being washed ashore in the area today. His whole narrative was delivered with that brazen smile on his face, which had recently become a stereotypical feature. He made no attempt to defend the actions, and obviously did not see much need to. He regarded them primarily as sensational. We found it all dreadful and shook our heads, which seemed to give him some satisfaction. "And you see no difficulty with your new party membership because of these things?" I remarked at last. Immediately he became defensive, and his face took on a bold Mussolini expression. "No, not at all," he declared. "Do you feel pity for these people? The man who shot first the day before yesterday knew that it would cost him his life, of course. It would have been bad form not to hang him. Incidentally, he has my respect. As for the others, shame on them. Why didn't they put up a fight? They were all long-time social democrats and members of the Eisern Front, a left-of-centre semi-military organisation formed by uniting the armed wings of all the left-of-centre parties except the communists. Why should they be lying in their beds in their nightshirts? They should have defended themselves and died decently, but they're a limp lot. I have no sympathy for them." "I don't know," I said slowly, "whether I feel much pity for them, but what I do feel is an indescribable sense of disgust at people who go around heavily armed and slaughter defenseless victims." "They should have defended themselves," said Brock stubbornly. "Then they wouldn't have been defenseless. That is a disgusting Marxist trick, being defenseless, when it gets serious." At this point Holtz intervened. "I consider the whole thing a regrettable revolutionary excess," he said, "and between you and me I expect the responsible officer to be disciplined. But I also think that it should not be overlooked that it was a social democrat who shot first. It is understandable, and in a certain sense even justified, that under these circumstances the SA takes, very energetic countermeasures." It was curious. I could just about stand Brock, but Holtz had become a red rag to me. I could not help myself. I felt compelled to insult him. "It is most interesting for me to hear your new theory of justification," I said. "If I am not mistaken, you did once study law." He gave me a steely look and elaborately picked up the gauntlet. "Yes, I have studied law," he said slowly, "and I remember that I heard something about state self-defense there. Perhaps you missed that lecture." "State self-defense," I said. "Interesting. You consider that the state is under attack because a few hundred social democrat citizens put on nightshirts and go to bed?" "Of course not," he said. "You keep forgetting it was a social democrat who first shot two SA men, who had broken into his home, who had entered his abode in the course of their official duty, and that allows the state the justification of self-defense against any other citizens, against me and you." "Not against me," he said, "but perhaps against you." He was now looking at me with really steely eyes, and I had a funny feeling in the back of my knees. "You," he said, "are always niggling and willfully ignoring the monumental developments in the resurgence of the German people that are taking place today." I can hear the very word resurgence to this day. "You grasp at every little excess and split legal hairs to criticize and find fault. You seem to be unaware, I fear, that today people of your ilk represent a latent danger for the state, and that the state has the right and the duty to react accordingly, at the very least when one of you goes so far as to dare to offer open resistance." Those were his words, soberly and slowly spoken in the style of a commentary on the Civil Code. All the while he looked at me with those steely eyes. "If we are dealing in threats," I said, "then why not openly? Do you intend to denounce me to the Gestapo?" About here, von Hagen and Hirsch began to titter, attempting to turn it all into a joke. This time, however, Holtz put a spanner in the works, quietly and deliberately, and it was only now that I realized, with a certain unexpected satisfaction, how deeply angered he was. "I admit that for some time I have been wondering whether that is not my duty." "Oh," I said. I needed a few moments to taste all the different flavors on my tongue. A little surprise, a little admiration for how far he was prepared to go, a little sourness from the word duty, a little satisfaction at how far I had driven him, and a new, cool insight. That is the way life is now, and that is how it has changed. And a little fear. Having made a quick assessment of what he might be able to say about me, if he went through with it, I said, "I must say that it does not speak for the seriousness of your intentions that you have been thinking about it for some time, only to tell me the result of your thoughts." "Don't say that," he said quietly. Now all the trumps had been played, and to raise the stakes further we would have had to become physical. It had all taken place sitting down, while we were smoking. Anyway, the others now intervened and reproachfully tried to calm us both down. Oddly enough, the political debate continued quietly and bitterly for several hours, but in reality the group had broken up. We made no arrangements for further meetings. Hirsch took leave of me in September to go to Paris. I had already lost sight of Brock and Holtz. I only heard snippets of gossip about their careers in later years. Hessel left for America a year later. The group had been blown apart. By the way, for a few days I was concerned that Holtz really would set the Gestapo onto me. As time passed, I realized that he had obviously not done so. It was decent of him, really.